150 years ago, on October 8th, 1871, there was a fire that raged through Chicago. You've probably heard of it, just the Great Chicago Fire. It's hard to even imagine how devastating that fire was. There were 17,500 buildings destroyed. I mean, the only thing we could equate it to today would be like a war zone. This is the view from the southwest corner of Dearborn and Monroe. So kind of in the modern day loop, we're talking a little bit west of the Art Institute, if you're familiar with Chicago. That's a view of a hotel that was left in the rubble. Here's another view a little bit north of there on Clark Street, looking north. You know, if you follow the street all the way up, you'll make it to Wrigley Field. But it was just devastating. Or how about this view? This picture is taken from about, as I understand it, where the Bean or the Cloud Gate is today. So this is like a block west of there. This is the Second Presbyterian Church. And just devastated. It's hard to fathom how incredibly devastating that fire was. As I mentioned, it destroyed nearly 18,000 buildings, killed 300. It left 100,000 people homeless, including a man who was a lawyer and an elder, not at this Presbyterian church, but another one up on Fullerton. Not only did he lose his home, but Horatio Spafford lost all of his real estate investments during that time, and he was heavily invested. The man lost a fortune in that fire. Well, about the same time, his only son, who was 4 years old, died of scarlet fever. And Horatio did what many men in the same situation would do, especially those who are driven. He just drowned his grief in his work. He put his nose down and kept working hard. And he not only worked in terms of financially, but also to care for the 100,000 people who had lost their homes. He did this serving in his church. Well, Spafford was a friend of a guy by the name of D.L. Moody. Maybe you've heard of D.L. Moody. He's like the Billy Graham of the late 1800s. I went to D.L. Moody's school, to Moody Bible Institute. And Moody and another friend of his, Ira Sankey, would go on these evangelistic tours and have these meetings. And at the time, they were heading to England. And so it was about 2 years after the fire in November of 1873, Moody and Sankey went to England and they were having evangelistic meetings in England. And Horatio, after years of just drowning himself in these things and all of the grief and trauma, decided we need a break. Let's go check out, he talks to his wife, let's go check out one of Moody's campaigns over there. We'll have some vacation. We just need to decompress. And so they start to head out. And I mean, they lost so much. They lost everything, including their son. But let me read a little bit more of the story of what happens then as he heads out. Well, they're getting ready to go enjoy vacation, and when an urgent matter detained Horatio on their way in New York. So he decided to send his wife Anna and their four daughters, Maggie, Tanita, Annie, and Bessie, on ahead. As he saw them settled into a cabin aboard the luxurious French liner, Ville de Havre, an unease filled his mind. And so he moved them to a room closer to the bow of the ship, and then he said goodbye, promised to join them soon. But during the small hours of November 22nd, 1873, as the ship glided over smooth seas, the passengers were jolted from their bunks. The ship collided with an iron sailing vessel, and water began pouring in like the Niagara. The boat tilted dangerously. Screams, prayers, and oaths emerged into a nightmare of unmeasured terror. Passengers clung to posts. They tumbled through darkness and were swept away by powerful currents of icy ocean. Loved ones fell from each other's grasp and disappeared beneath the waters. The 226 fatalities included Spafford's daughters, Maggie, Tanita, Annie, and Bessie. Mrs. Spafford was found nearly unconscious, clinging to a piece of the wreckage. When the 47 survivors landed in Cardiff, Wales, she cabled her husband, "Saved alone." Horatio immediately booked passage to join his wife. En route, on a cold December night, the captain called him aside and said, "I believe we're now passing over the place where the ship went down." Spafford went to his cabin, but he found it hard to sleep. And so he said to himself, "It is well. The will of God be done." And he later wrote the famous hymn, "It Is Well With My Soul," based on those words. Maybe you're familiar with it. "Peace like a river tendeth my..." I mean, he just goes on, and it's just, it's heartbreaking as you read this. Spafford said he saw God's hand in his losses. He just believed that God was still in control, and it deepened his trust and his ability to comfort others. But man, what an incredible story. Both this man's loss and trauma, but also his deep faith. How did he do that? I mean, how do you get to the point that you have that kind of perspective in those incredibly hard times to even utter something like that? It's well. God's will be done. You know, sometimes things happen to us. We can't figure out what's happening. I guarantee you that's what Horatio felt. You know, things like, why am I going through this? Maybe they're coming to mind right now. Or why did I go through that? Why would God, if he loves me so much, I mean, that's what I hear all the time. And why would he allow me, one who loves him so much, go through all of this? What do you do in those moments? Well, I would suggest what I've heard another pastor suggest. You need a waiting for more information file. What do I mean by that? Well, when you find yourself asking questions like that, you just got to stop and file that experience in the file, waiting for more information, for further information. You don't have the whole picture yet, but God does. You may never get the whole picture, but you might. But you may not this side of heaven. So put it in the file waiting for further information. You know, we've been studying the life of Joseph in Genesis, and his file was huge. We heard Horatio's file. It was huge. On this side of heaven, I don't know that he ever got perspective of, why did all these things happen? Why did I lose everything I owned? Why did I lose my son? Why did I lose my four daughters? But because he knew where to file it, and he had been walking with Jesus for such a long time, he could look back and go, you know what? I don't have all the information now, so I can file that away and trust that the one who does know will make it clear, if he wants to, someday, and I can trust him. His will be done. Joseph's file like that was huge. You know, we've been studying his life together in Genesis, and in his life, it was a pretty big file. Some incredibly painful, trauma-filled, unexplainable things happened to him, and it started when he was a 17-year-old boy, and his brothers sell him into slavery. They beat him up, throw him in a well because they're jealous of him, and they sell him off to these Midianite traders who take him as a slave, traffic him into Egypt, where he's sold in slavery again to a guy by the name of Potiphar. Potiphar is this leader in Egypt, and Joseph's character begins to shine through, and over time, he actually gains Potiphar's trust, and Potiphar puts him in charge of everything in his house, and things are going well for Joseph. Hey, it's an upswing. Finally. Until Potiphar's wife catches an eye for Joe, and she tries to seduce him, but he refuses, and he continues to refuse, and finally, she accuses him of rape. He gets thrown into prison. Now what? Well, in prison, same thing. After some time, he gains the trust of the warden of the prison, and he's put in charge of so many things there. And he's there, and finally, Pharaoh, he runs afoul with his cupbearer and his baker, and he throws them into the same prison. And they have these disturbing dreams that Joseph, by God's grace, interprets. And when what he interpreted comes true, the cupbearer was restored and the baker was hanged, he was hopeful that, hey, I'm finally going to get out. My fortunes are up again. God sees me. The cupbearer is going to tell Pharaoh, I'm going to get out of here. But the cupbearer totally forgot him. And there he is, forgotten in prison. He forgot him for 2 years until Pharaoh had some dreams of his own that didn't make a lot of sense. And he's looking for someone to interpret them. And then the cupbearer goes, oh, I had this experience. I met this guy in prison named Joe. I bet he could help you. And so Joseph gets out. And sure enough, he interprets Pharaoh's dreams, interprets them truthfully, that there would be 7 years of bounty followed by 7 years of famine. And so he tells Pharaoh, hey, you better store up things during those 7 good years so that in those 7 lean years, because it's not just going to be Egypt, it's going to be the whole region, in those 7 lean years, you're going to be able to provide for everyone. And Pharaoh's like, you know what? We need somebody to be in charge of all that. How about you? And he puts Joseph in charge. And Joseph rises up to be the second most powerful man in all of Egypt next to Pharaoh. Maybe we should call him Pharaoh Joe. Because he would have been dressed in all the Egyptian garb and probably looked a lot like a Pharaoh and an Egyptian figure. Well, among all those who begin coming to Egypt for grain are Joseph's brothers. And we saw the last couple weeks, they show up and Joseph recognizes them. They don't recognize him. And suddenly that waiting for further information file gets just dumped out on his desk right in front of him. If you're familiar with the story, then you know Joseph's brothers had come looking for grain and Joseph recognized them. They didn't recognize him. And last week we saw not only their first return, but their second return with Benjamin in tow. Because at first time it was only his 10 older brothers. And so he says, hey, you guys got to go back before I sell you, before I give you any more. And the next time before you return, you need to come back with your dad and with your younger brother. See, Joseph had a younger brother as well named Benjamin. And as ransom, he kept one of his brothers, Simeon, put him in prison. But they don't know this is Joseph yet. It's just Fair Joe to them, like Pharaoh. And so they go back and they wait, and it's a long time, but finally they come back. And we saw that last Sunday. They come back with Benjamin. And Joseph puts some tests in front of them to discern their heart and see, can I believe these guys? Can I trust them now? Are they still the same guys that sold me away? And a final test, he puts a silver cup in Benjamin's bag of grain, the youngest one, and he sends them back, and then he sends somebody after them, and they catch him, and they say, okay, he's got to come back with us and go to prison. And Joseph's test was to see, would they abandon Benjamin and just sell him off and let him go like they did him, or would they stick with him? Well, they all come back with Benjamin. And you'll remember this from last Sunday. And at the end, as we wrapped up, Judah is one of Joseph's brothers, actually the guy who coined up the idea, hey, let's sell him and make some money. Judah starts pleading for Benjamin before Joseph. And he says, you've got to let him come back. His dad loves him. And I gave surety that he would make it back. I mean, if he doesn't come back, I'm a dead man. And I can't imagine. It'll kill my dad. It'll absolutely kill him if he loses another son. And he says this, and I quote, he says, I fear to see the evil that would find my father. And that's where we pick it up, heading into Genesis chapter 45 this morning. So let's keep reading. Then Joseph, when this happens, this is the same scene from last Sunday. We just didn't finish it. He couldn't control himself before those who stood by him. He cried. He said, make everyone go after me. Remember, he is second only to Pharaoh. He's got all kinds of people whose respect he demands and commands and attendance to him. And he's like, everybody out except for these guys. And so everybody goes out except for him and his brothers. No one stayed when Joseph made himself known, and he wept aloud, so loud that the Egyptians heard it. The household of Pharaoh heard it. Joseph is wailing. Why? Well, his waiting for further information file, it was probably more like a box, just got dumped out in front of him. And he couldn't do it anymore. And Joseph said to his brothers, he said, I'm Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers couldn't answer him. They were dismayed at his presence. I mean, can you imagine what they thought? He takes off the earrings. He pulls off the beard. He takes off the headdress. He's like, no, I'm Joseph. And he starts speaking to them, not in Egyptian, but in Hebrew. Can you imagine how shocking that scene would have been? And so he said to his brothers, come near to me, please. And they come near and he said, I am your brother, Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Well, what's Joseph do next? Well, one thing I'd suggest, I've already said it, is you're going to see it this morning, is that the longer we walk with Jesus, the more adept we are at recognizing his hand. And Joseph, who's been walking with the Lord for decades now, in this moment, the response we're going to see come out of him is entirely because of this. He's been walking with Jesus. He's been walking with God through all the ups, through all the downs, and all the other downs, and all the other downs. And because of that, because he trusts the Lord, and over time this has developed for him, he's able to look back now and recognize God's hand. I don't know if Joe could have done this, if this had all happened like within a year of him getting sold into slavery, right? It was this long, steady growth that really enabled him. This long, steady, as one pastor calls it, obedience in the same direction that enabled Joe to respond the way he's about to. You ever wonder why our logo is a tree? One of the reasons is, how does a tree grow? Slow. Right? But when it grows well, are you going to knock that tree over? No. It's rooted and it's deep and it's a monument of faith. That's how our lives are supposed to be. The psalmist says that we'd be like trees planted by streams of water whose roots go deep. So the longer you follow Jesus, over time, and I'm not saying it's easy, but you'll be able to at least look back and recognize God's hand, so it gives you hope to keep going, even in the midst of some incredibly hard things. That's Joseph in this moment. The more we walk with him, the more we trust him, the more we recognize his grace and his mercy and his goodness as we look back over our lives. And as I just said, even in the hardest things, this was Joe. He'd been following God for decades. He had been through lifetimes worth of hurt. But he kept going and following and trusting. Listen, I'm guessing that there's some really dark moments Joseph had that are not recorded in this book. If you've trusted Jesus, you and I can ask him about him when we're in heaven. But in this moment now, after decades of that, he's able to look back and see God's hand. Here's what he says to them. Here's how he responds. He says, now don't be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. And remember, this is coming through tears and wailing. Look at that. For God sent me before you to preserve life. Wow. These are the guys who sold him into slavery and totally betrayed him. And now he's saying, I've had some time to think about this, and I've seen God work in my life, and I've seen God's goodness. Guys, I think God was at work even in your evil. He sent me here. to preserve your life and so many others. For the famine in the land these 2 years, see, this is 2 years into those 7 years of famine, there's still 5 years left in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. There it is again, verse 7, God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it wasn't you who sent me here, but God. Go ask Joseph that when he's in Potiphar's house and Potiphar's wife accuses him of rape. Or go back and ask him that when he's in the bottom of the well and he's being loaded on the carts to go with the Midianites. Or go ask him that when he's forgotten for 2 years in prison. Do you think in those moments he's able to answer necessarily, yeah, God sent me here? I don't know. I'm guessing in those moments it was incredibly hard. And it was some days, yeah, he could trust God. And other days he's like, God, where in the world are you? And I give up. But he kept going, didn't he? He kept going. And in this moment now, it wasn't you to send me here, verse 8, but God, he's made me a father to Pharaoh and Lord of all his house, ruler over all the land of Egypt. Joe didn't see it way back then in all those places, but he sees it now. You may not see it now, but if you keep walking with Jesus by his grace on this side of heaven or the next, by his grace, you'll see it then. Keep going, even in the hardest things. For we know that for those who love God, he works those even awful things for good. He never calls them good, but he can work good from it. And you can count it joy, like Jesus' little brother said, when you meet trials of various kinds, because you know that testing, it produces steadfastness and endurance to help you keep going and keep trusting. The psalmist said, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil. Why? Because you're with me. Your rod and your staff comfort me. So for you, when facing those things that you're not sure, where have you seen God work? Even if you don't sense him and know him in the moment, sense his presence in the moment, he's still present. He hasn't changed. He still loves you. He's still with you. And because you can look in the rearview mirror and see what's happening there, you can look through the windshield and keep going forward. And this is the perspective that ultimately enabled Joseph to even forgive his brothers. And it can enable you and I to forgive the hardest things. Look how Joe responds. He says, listen, guys, hurry up. Go back to dad. Say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God's made me Lord over all of Egypt. Come down to me. Don't tarry. Hurry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near me, you and your children and your children's children, your flocks, your herds, everything you have. Guys, go get dad. And here, I'll provide for you. There's still 5 years of famine left. So would you just come? Now your eyes see and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it's my mouth, Joseph tells them, who speaks to you. You have to tell my father of all my honor in Egypt and of all that you've seen. Hurry, bring my father down here. Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck. Benjamin was his only full brother. They had the same mom. And he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And after that, his brothers talked with him. Can you imagine that conversation? Then can you imagine his brothers going, we got to go home and tell dad what happened 20 years ago. Ouch. But Joseph forgave them. He talked with them. Didn't berate them. Their relationship was being restored. Now we're going to see even next Sunday, there's still mistrust there. It's not perfect. but it's better. And that's how we should forgive, is as Christ forgave us. As Christ forgave us. And Jesus even said, if you'll forgive others their sins and their trespasses, your heavenly Father will forgive you. You get to actually be like Jesus when you forgive. But I would tell you, doing that is really hard. And sometimes it can take decades of walking with the Lord before you're finally even able to. Because forgiveness is costly to you. And it's really hard. But it's possible. It's possible. And so you'll see God's hand then and recognize it more and more as you walk with Jesus. And in doing so, we're going to turn our attention now to Joseph's dad as they go back to get him. You're able to take risks to follow him. Let's keep reading. When the report was heard in Pharaoh's house that Joseph's brothers had come, it pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And so Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load up your beasts, your horses, your camels, everything you got. Go back to the land of Canaan. Take your father and your households and come to me. I'll give you the best of the land of Egypt and you shall eat of the land. This was a big turn of events, wasn't it? These guys were scared to death of Joe earlier. Of Joseph, I mean, their lives were in his hand. And now all of a sudden, Pharaoh shows up. And he's like, yeah, bring everybody. It'd be awesome. And you, Joseph, are commanded to say, do this, take wagons from the land of Egypt for your little ones and for your wives and bring your father and come. Have no concern for your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. So the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and he sends them all back. He gives them all a change of clothes, but to Benjamin, notice he gives how many? Five. And he gives him 300 shekels of silver. And then to his father, he sends 10 donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt and 10 female donkeys with grain and bread and provision for the journey. And he sends his brothers away. And I love this. As they departed, he said to them, hey, just bite it on your way back. Like, no quarreling, no fighting, no blaming. Just enjoy this moment. Go back and get dad. He knows what they're like, doesn't he? And so they went up out of Egypt and they came to the land of Canaan to their father Jacob, and they told him, Joseph's still alive. He is the ruler over all the land of Egypt. If you're Jacob, what are you thinking in that moment? You think your son's been dead for 20 years, more than that. Well, his heart became numb. He didn't believe them. But when they reiterated everything, told him all the words that he had said to them, and when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. And Israel said, that's Jacob, he said, it's enough then. He's still alive. I'll go down and see him before I die. So Israel took his journey with all that he had, and he came to Beersheba, or Beersheba. Maybe you've seen that town in the news this week. There was a hospital hit with a rocket late this week that was pretty much destroyed in this town. If you would go there, I've had the great privilege of being able to go there about 15 years ago, and there's the ancient site of Beersheba where Jacob stops, and right next to it is the modern city of Beersheba. These are real places. There were real events that really happened. And when he came there, he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in visions of the night, and he said, Jacob, Jacob. Remember, Jacob was familiar with this, wasn't he? A number of times when we studied his life earlier this year, February, March, in that time period, Jacob had dreams where God spoke to him. And he's doing it again here in his old age. He said, Jacob says, well, here I am. And he said to him, he said, I'm the God of your father. Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you into a great nation. I myself will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also bring you up again, and Joseph's hand shall close your eyes. Jacob, in this moment, he stops. Why does he stop at Beersheba? Well, to worship, to seek God, and to trust him. Part of the reason he stops, though, is really historic. Abraham had stopped here. His father, Isaac, had stopped here. They had both worshiped God in this place. When? Well, on the way to Egypt. And they'd been warned not to go. Isaac was warned not to go. And so Jacob's like, I don't know if I should go or not. It's a famine again, and I'm going to Egypt. Am I not trusting you then, God? And God says, no, I'll be with you. Go. He's able to take this risk of trusting him and worship him and go forward. And you and I, same thing. See, again, the longer we walk with Jesus, the more we recognize his hand, but then the more we're able to hear his voice, to know his voice from his word and through prayer, and to trust him and to follow. Writer of Proverbs, seek the Lord, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't lean on your own understanding, but in all your ways acknowledge him. He'll make your paths straight. God promises, I'll teach you, I'll instruct you in the way you shall go. I'll counsel you, how? With my eye on you. Seek him, ask him, go to him. Isaiah, he says, you'll hear a word. This is the way, walk in it. And it gives you courage then to not only take that risk as you seek him, but to obey it with courage. Keep reading here. Then Jacob sent out from Beersheba. The sons of Israel carried Jacob, their father, their little ones, their wives, and the wagons Pharaoh had sent to carry him. And they keep going, and they make their way, all their livestock, their goods, everything, and they made their way in Egypt. I wonder, what about for you? This becomes an easier task. I don't know if I should say easier as much as you're more willing to take a risk and to trust God the longer you walk with Jesus. At least you should be. Now, sometimes when you're really young in your faith, you don't know any better. You're like, yeah, let's go. But by God's grace, really, it should be the other way, right? The longer we walk with him, the more apt we are to be able to and want to take those risks and follow him. And Jacob does it, and he follows. Jesus told Joshua in Joshua 1, verse 9, I believe this is Jesus speaking to him, have I not commanded you, be strong and courageous, don't be frightened, don't be dismayed. The Lord your God's with you wherever you go. Or Hebrews 11, by faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go to a place that he had never been. He didn't even know where he's going. And in his old age, he follows the Lord. And other people notice it and see it in you too, including other people in this room, and we're encouraged by your faith. When people saw the boldness of Peter and John, they perceived they were uneducated common men. They were astonished. They recognized these dudes have been with Jesus. They'd been seeking him and trusting him. Hey, do you know, just really briefly here before we wrap this morning, how are you doing it? Taking risks as you walk with and follow Jesus. That's been our theme this ministry year, right? Like back to September, enduring courage. And we said, hey, the people of Wawasee Bible, not the pastors, but all of us, including me, to take three faith-filled risks. I want to build that muscle of following Jesus and taking risks. So a gospel risk of sharing our faith and pursuing someone who's far from God. A financial risk in giving, a comfort risk, getting out of our comfort zone to follow him. How have you been doing at that? You got a couple months yet. We're going to take those risks together. I'll tell you how I'm doing. On the gospel risk, by God's grace, he's brought some relationships into my life that have been good. I've had opportunity to share the gospel and to talk about those things and people I'm praying for by name on a regular basis. I participated in evangelism shift this year. That was both a gospel risk and kind of a comfort risk because it took away some of my weekends. A financial risk. We've been, by God's grace, been giving more this year as a family. A comfort risk. Well, both of those were kind of uncomfortable to a degree. And another one, though, I think of right away is this year we've been, my day off is Wednesdays. And every Wednesday morning now at 6 a.m., it's my day to sleep in. It was my idea. I don't understand why. But our elders get on Zoom and pray. Hey, if you'd like us to pray for you, would you let me know? And we'll pray for you Wednesday morning. Any Wednesday? How are you doing at taking those risks? Let's follow Jesus, recognize his hand so those risks are easier to take. Well, Jacob takes the risk, he goes. And see, as we do that, here's the why behind it. Here's what it enables. It enables us to live and do those things, to see his hand and to take risks for God's glory and others' good and for our joy. There's joy in it when you follow Jesus. It's not to say there's never pain or there's never hardship or it's never hard or never uncomfortable. But there is joy. And it brings glory to God and it brings good to others. And it brings joy to you. As we wrap up the text this morning, we see joy in Jacob and his family's life. Verse 27 of chapter 47. So Jacob settled in the land of Egypt. Israel settled there. In the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions of it and were fruitful, and they multiplied greatly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. So the days of his life were 147 years. And when the time drew near that he must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, "If now I've found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh, promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Don't bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out, bury me in their burying place." And he answered, "I'll do as you said." He said, "Swear to me," and he swore to him. Then Israel bowed himself upon the head of his bed. What are some of the hard things you're facing right now? Can you look back and see God's hand so that you can trust him to keep going forward now? You may not see the why now, but you will see it then. What's the risk he's put in front of you to take as you follow him? What's the risk? A gospel risk, a financial risk, a comfort risk? Have you seen God be faithful to you then? He'll be faithful to you now. And you can take that risk and take that step of faith and see him be faithful again then. For God's glory, others' good, and for your joy. Let me pray.